ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, does democracy die in a news desert? We dig into the hard ground of Australian regional journalism.
A global media titan has found itself up for sale, not entirely by choice.
And Media Musical Chairs goes into overdrive as we race through upfront season.
So, Tim, it feels like we're entering a bit of an end-of-year frenzy with the merger, acquisition and sale of various mega media companies. But perhaps they're not all actually willing participants.
Yeah, it's happening locally, it's happening globally. One of the unwilling or potentially unwilling participants is Warner Brothers Discovery. This is a company that not that long ago announced that it had a nice steady plan to split itself into two. So it was going to have a kind of a streaming and studio side and then a kind of the old-fashioned linear side that was unflatteringly known in the TV industry as Crapco, as they prepared to find a side that was fast-growing and valuable, and then the rest. So when we think about who Warner Brothers Discovery is, in Australia we might know them for HBO Max, the streaming service. If you happen to tune into The Golden Bachelor on Monday night.
I did happen to tune into The Golden Bachelor on Monday night.
Well, that's a whole other conversation we'll have to have later on then, I think, Viv. But that was made by Warner Brothers Discovery, for instance. They also own news services like CNN, for instance. So a big global organisation. And now they seem to have accepted that they're probably going to have to sell themselves because they've said... there's what they describe as unsolicited interest.
Yeah, what does that actually mean? How could a company be for sale if it doesn't want to be for sale?
Well, one of the things is the board of a company like that, they have a duty to represent the best interests of the shareholders. And what we do know is that Paramount's new owners, Skydance, have knocked on the door, I believe it's three times now, to make increasing offers. And there's at some point where the board has to start listening, even if they had a preferred other options. So they've now, the phrase is reviewing options, but effectively that's opening the door for people to come forward and make their best offer.
Now, if Skydance did buy Warner Brothers Discovery, that would also have implications for us here in Australia, because Skydance now owns Paramount, which now owns Network 10, one of our three commercial television free-to-air stations. So all of these really big moves which end up with strange merged entity names that might seem like they're a world away, actually mean that various American billionaires will end up owning our local content production, right?
Yeah, and that's been an increasing trend for years. You know, we're more globalized than ever, and as you say, you know, 10 is the free-to-air network, which is now globally aligned with Paramount. Although it does seem like Skydance Paramount, if there is a favorite at this stage, they're not the only one in play. It's possible that Comcast, another one of the global giants, might come in. So they're the people who own NBC, for instance, in the US, along with the streaming service Peacock, which hasn't yet launched in Australia. But then you might think that because of the studio side, and Warner Brothers is one of the kind of the original big five US studios, think things like Harry Potter, for instance, that could be quite attractive for one of the kind of the global platforms. So possibly an Amazon or an Apple could come in for it. So there are a few options yet.
The only thing that I think we can be certain of is that we're going to end up having to say more complicated business names with letters: CNN, HBO, DC Studios, WBD. I'm losing track and it's only October.
And it's A-OK with me, Viv. So So last week, Viv, we chatted about Killing Season in the radio world, and that moving and shaking hasn't stopped.
Yeah, last week, Laura Byrne and Brittany Hockley were in the news when it emerged that their podcast, Life Uncut, was finishing up at ARN, which led to all sorts of speculation about their radio show, The Pickup, which is on KISS as well. And at the time, it seemed a little odd that one of the most successful podcasts in Australia that also has a national radio show might not have a new home to go to.
Well, a week is a long time in broadcasting. This week, a move to Southern Cross Austereo was confirmed for the pair. I think you actually broke the story, didn't you, Viv?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, it was odd that the podcast that is number 7 on the most recent Australian podcast ranker that also has a national presence via radio would up and leave or maybe be told to leave a radio network. And that just wasn't clear what had happened. And as I was digging into that, I found that they have signed with Listener, which is the digital and podcast platform of Southern Cross Austereo. Now, they own in Australia the Triple M network. Unlikely that Laura and Britt would end up on Triple M unless Triple M was having a complete overhaul of its brand.
Triple M quite likes rock.
So they're more likely to end up on the Hit Network, which has Today FM in Sydney, Fox in Melbourne, and a presence all around the country. We don't yet have an answer to this. We know their podcast will be with Listener, but I suspect there will be a point where they also end up on the Hit Network.
And that's not where the moves ended. We also had news out of Brisbane as well.
Yeah, so if you're a Brisbane listener, you might have heard of Robin, Kip and Corey Oates, who are the breakfast show on KISS 97.3. A note emerged, I wouldn't say it was released, from ARN Corporate, letting the company know that that show would not be back.
Explain emerged?
Well, screenshots of the email were sent around to various journalists, including myself. And I think in commercial radio, when you're making announcements about talent and programming, you must write these emails knowing that they're going to leak. So even though ARN Media are not making their big announcements about what's happening in 2026 until their big event next week, this email has revealed Robin, Kip and Corey Oates won't be back next year, although we don't yet know what will take their place, although it seems like it will not be Kyle and Jackie O for now.
That's right, because they've emphasised it will be, and I remember reading that in the leaked email, live and local was the phrase.
Yes, and Kyle and Jackie are both based in Sydney, so they couldn't get away with saying that if it was going to be them. So who knows, we could have something. They said it's going to be focused on energy and music, so we don't know yet if that's a placeholder or if they are actually overhauling their strategy and no longer continuing down the path of Kyle and Jackie O across the country.
Well, we'll find out about that at the ARN Upfront next Wednesday. This week it was also the 7 Upfront, which you and I were both at, Viv. We really are in media announcement season now, aren't we?
Yeah, we really are. And I mean, there wasn't anything hugely new to come out of that event. One of the tent poles that they spent a lot of time on was Home and Away, which is a decades-old, long-running soap opera. Their contention was, we don't have to pretend that it's exciting or shiny and new. It still pulls incredible numbers. And if a streamer had it, they would be boasting about it. So we need to learn to tell our story better. They also talked a lot more about, they said, consistency rather than novelty, which in a way I can see what they're saying, but it wasn't particularly inspiring or exciting to hear. Essentially, we're not going to try new things because we don't need to.
And that had been the same message from Nine the week
from
before.
All of them, really.
Yeah. And I think when we talked about Nine last week, I described it as the first TV upfront of the season, which I gather we've had feedback since that SBS is feeling a little left out.
Yeah,
describing it that way.
SBS had already had their upfront event and announced what they were doing with their content slate in 2026. So they were a little disappointed that you had forgotten them. So I think you'll just say a quick sorry to SBS, Tim.
I'm happy to always apologise to SBS. And our solidarity this week goes out to investigative journalist Nick McKenzie, whose home has been attacked this month.
Nick works for The Age, the Sydney Morning Herald, and 60 Minutes, all of which are owned by Nine. And I think we could say he's one of their most prominent investigative journalists who's taken on some of the biggest stories that have emerged from that outlet for quite some time.
Yeah, and this sort of attack, which police say was caught on CCTV, as an example of some of the kind of the chilling stuff that goes on behind the scenes that we don't always find out about when investigative journalists are covering corruption of all flavours. I'm sure that this particular incident will be something which is in everybody's minds when the Walkleys come together to recognise this year's best journalists next month. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Regional news in Australia has been in a decline for some time now, in quantity at least.
Yeah, between 2019 and 2024, there were 358 contractions and 174 expansions of news outlets across Australia. So that's a loss of at least 184 outlets.
It's been a struggle, and it's ultimately audiences who end up missing out. The Public Interest Journalism Initiative says that as of last year, there are at least 29 local government areas who didn't have any print or digital news at all.
A report from the University of Canberra and RMIT, Engaged Journalism in the Heartland, is trying to understand how audiences are affected by this and what could be done.
One of the authors of that report is senior lecturer at RMIT and a former visual journalist, Dr. TJ Thompson. TJ, welcome to Medialand.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with the definitions. What is local news? What kind of coverage are we actually talking about here?
So the short and sweet answer in our research is everything that's not metropolitan. So that includes regional centres like Ballarat and Toowoomba, regional towns like Busselton, all the way to remote and very remote communities like Alice Springs and Ravensthorpe. So anything that's not metropolitan is kind of in the scope of this research on local news and hyperlocal news.
I was just about to ask that, TJ. I keep hearing this term hyperlocal, and I'm not 100% clear on what it means. Does it mean like news about what's happening in my specific street? How is it different from local?
Yeah, so it does try to delve down a little bit more deeply into a particular postcode or sometimes even a street or a couple streets, that kind of thing. So it could be a suburb in Melbourne instead of like a Melbourne-wide outlet. So really trying to drill down and get the local community, the local postcode, the local vibe of a few streets or an area.
Now, I've been already bombarding our listeners with a few statistics as we were introducing this conversation. It feels to me when you hear those numbers that things are pretty bad. Would you say that local news is in some sort of existential crisis at the moment?
There certainly are challenges, but I think what's really nice is I've had the pleasure of spending a number of months in the last 2 years in regional, rural, remote communities, spending time in newsrooms, talking to community members, hearing about what's going on, how the news is made, what people want from their news. And I think what's positive and encouraging is that there is this really big hunger for local news. People do want to hear about what's going on, you know, on their street, around their street, in the neighborhood, who the new neighbors are, what businesses are opening or closing. There's so much hunger for local content and local relevant, unique content. And so I think that's a really encouraging thing, is that people do want this very much so.
Is that appetite being filled, TJ, though, by local Facebook community groups? For example, I know I've spent some time in Mallacoota in regional Victoria, which has been subject to some horrific bushfires over the years, and that even made the national news headlines. But a lot of communication down there in terms of what's happening with emergency services, what's happening with crime, what's happening with local businesses, actually takes place in these private Facebook groups.
It does help. These groups, I think, help to an extent and to a degree, but they're not the end-all be-all. So you can potentially get some information about crime activity or local business activity, that kind of thing, but it's not going to be a complete picture. So you're not going to get necessarily comprehensive coverage of what the council's doing. You're not going to get coverage of, you know, migration or refugees or different parts of the community that might not be seen or heard from often. It is very much just a very narrow and scattershot approach of what's going on in the community with these groups. We also find on these groups a lot of misinformation, a lot of vitriol, a lot of bullying and harassment. So they're not, you know, very, very wholesome places for democratic discourse to happen, I think.
I do just want to point out that if anyone is listening to Medialand from Mallacoota, I'm in no way implying that their group was vitriolic. I found
it
very...
Oh, that's far too late, Viv.
I found it very, very helpful. The other thing that's in these groups is obviously a lot of videos. You know, even if people spot a koala somewhere with the dwindling population, they'll post it so that people know that the wildlife is still surviving, if not thriving. What's happening with citizen visual journalism at the moment, TJ?
Visuals are so important. So as much as we write and we speak and we communicate in words, we also communicate non-verbally. We also communicate through images and videos and charts and infographics and all sorts of other things as well. And those are so important to our online digital media culture. We're kind of awash with visuals, and we do process those in our brains differently to text. So they really do grab us, grab hold of our attention, and help us understand whether we want to spend time to look at the story or engage with this source or not. So we are seeing a lot of video online, especially with younger audiences. They do like that short, snappy, vertical video approach. And some outlets aren't being as adaptive to those changing audience preferences and consumption patterns. And so I think there is an opportunity to do more visuals and more relevant, unique visuals to ensure that you're kind of reaching your entire audience base that you want to.
Is that an element of training for the journalists involved? I came out through local newspapers, so my kind of typical experience as a journalist was I'd be sent off to, let's say, a 50th wedding anniversary. I would be accompanied by a photographer. They would get the pictures. I would get the words. As a then junior reporter, I would forget to ask what the secret of a long and happy marriage was, and the photographer would just gently ask the question for me, having heard it asked many a time before. But I get the sense now that it's probably the journalist is also taking the photograph. And now, as you suggest, perhaps video too. That seems like a lot.
It is a lot. And if we think about training and education, those are important things to think about. We spend a lot of time in our early education learning about, you know, grammar and writing and speaking, but we usually don't get that same kind of focus and that intense, sustained focus on visual communication. So we might have an elective art class or a photography class that you can take if you want to, optionally, but there's not necessarily the same sustained attention to visual communication as there is to written and spoken communication. I think that kind of continues into university in some settings. And then on the job, you do kind of just get oftentimes given a camera or given your iPhone and saying, you know, good luck, take a lot of photos, hope one works out kind of thing. There's not really that literacy a lot of times and that education formally with structured training to how to use visual platforms in effective ways.
Do you think that the regional audiences themselves are noticing this, TJ? We spend a lot of time talking about it from a media perspective and from a jobs perspective, but how does it actually impact people on the ground who aren't maybe seeing the visual storytelling from media organizations that they used to?
So the audience perspective is so important. And that's one of the reasons why we did this report. We surveyed almost 7 or 8,000 Australians across the country. We looked at content. We interviewed through qualitative interviews about 200 people across regional, rural, remote parts of Australia. And audiences are observing, they tell us they're observing a decrease in quantity and quality of their local news. So there is this really big hunger for local news, but for most audiences, they're not kind of fully satisfied when it comes to quantity and quality.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're speaking to Dr. TJ Thompson, who is a senior lecturer at RMIT and former visual journalist, about the changing landscape of local and hyper-local news. TJ, one of the phrases we hear when talking about this landscape is that it's now a desert, a news desert, if you will. What does that phrase mean when we're thinking about storytelling and news?
So news deserts are places where you don't have access to news provision. So it might be that they're, you know, 50 Ks, 100 Ks, 200 Ks away. You don't have anything kind of quite close to you to be able to use for your local news information. And so when you don't have access to local news, there's a lot of implications for that. Local council isn't being covered. There's not as much accountability for politicians, for the spending of public money. There's not opportunity for investigative journalism to uncover issues that could help things be done better, more exposure to misinformation, more cynicism and distrust about what's kind of coming out there, who to trust, what to trust. And then kind of just thinking about social cohesion as well. We like to be part of our communities. We like to know who's part of our communities. And local news helps us feel like we're part of those communities. They help us feel like we're part of the broader society. And so without those local news outlets, there's implications for democracy, for trust in people and citizens and organizations. There's a lot of, I think, negative implications if you don't have access to local news.
Yeah, I want to talk about that democratic implication because I've noticed even with my Sydney-based local council, they themselves have become really good at social media and telling their own stories. But we then don't really have any local journalism to sort of maybe tell if there is a darker side or for any kind of accountability. So in a way, we're getting a visualization of the council and the councillors and the council process, but we're only getting one side of the story. How dramatic could that be for democracy and accountability?
Yeah, I think one-sided accounts aren't good any way you look at it. Whether it's government or whether it's business, whether it's society, hearing just one side of the story can sound very good or very bad, depending on who's telling the story and what they're saying about the story. So I think you do need different perspectives to get a little bit more of a triangulated, comprehensive understanding of what's going on. And without that kind of comprehensive understanding, you do get potential for bias, potential for misleading things, potential for even falsehoods or omissions that can deceive people. So I think that balance, that multitude of sources is really important.
If we look back at a decade or two, the local news landscape used to be such that the council agenda would come in, a reporter would go through it before the council meeting had taken place, look for anything that was potentially contentious. They'd then show up at the council meeting and listen to the discussion. They you know, effectively be holding the councillors to account. You know, those journalists would be sitting in court every day. They'd be visiting the local police station every day, the local ambulance station, the fire station, etc. That's just not happening now. A lot of local journalism is already lost, isn't it?
It is in some ways. And without trying to be too positive or think that tech can save the world, because I don't think it can, but I think tech can play a role, this might be where we can turn to newer technologies like AI to try to make a difference and be a bit more strategic in where we invest our time. So AI, I think, is very good at structured data. And so if you have structured data from a council or from a police service, it can do a lot for you in terms of getting patterns or trends or themes that you are interested in. And then a journalist can kind of take the time to sift through those and say, we actually want to spend some time reporting on this issue or talk to these sources, that kind of thing. Maybe tech can help us do this a little bit better since we have so few people on the ground.
One of the other solutions that tends to come up when there's a tragedy or some big environmental event in a local community is non-local journalists are kind of flown in from a more central location, and suddenly these local communities find themselves swamped by people who perhaps don't understand the dynamics and the nuances of that area. What's the dynamic there when it's sort of fly-in, fly-out journos telling stories?
I think parachute journalism isn't an ideal thing in any circumstance. Ideally, you want people who have grown up in the community, who know the community, who know the history of the community, the norms and mores and all that kind of thing of the community. That's the ideal situation. But when you do get big kind of nationally breaking news, oftentimes you do get people parachuting in who don't have connection to the community or accountability to community, and that is problematic. But I think you see, even without big national breaking news happening, you also see a lot of journalists out in the regions didn't grow up in those communities. They're coming in from urban areas, from metropolitan parts of the coasts, coming in to the regions for a year or two, and then leaving. And that's kind of an extended form of parachute journalism, I would argue. So I think if we can try to have more homegrown journalists doing work in their own communities, I think that's a really beautiful thing, because they have that unique connection and history and accountability to the community that many other people don't have.
Well, Dr. TJ Thompson is a senior lecturer at RMIT and a former visual journalist. TJ, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you both, Tim, Viv.
Okay, Tim, any other business before we wrap up?
Well, I had another little experiment this week, Viv. A new browser has popped up, which doesn't happen that often. You know, I can vaguely remember my excitement when Google's Chrome came along more than a decade ago. This time it's from OpenAI, and it's a browser called Atlas.
So as someone who perhaps doesn't care as much about browser launches as you do, can you tell me why that is in any way interesting or exciting?
Well, think about how much of your time and your life goes through that.
I don't want to.
Chrome browser. Yeah, that's the scary thing. And for the platforms, it becomes a really important way of making money because they know what people do for Google. It helps them in their hold over the advertising ecosystem, for instance. So this is a big challenger for Google's ability to make money.
So tell me what the pitch is for this open AI one, or what its point of difference is, because I know that Google is sort of the one that's really easy to use and integrates with a lot of Google's other products, such as the search engine. Microsoft tends to focus on its privacy and security element versus that of Google. What can OpenAI offer me in a web browser?
Yeah, really, it feels like you've got ChatGPT right there. So that's one of those things. Now, if you're already using ChatGPT, one of the kind of really notable things is how easy it is to move across. All of those bookmarks you've got, all of your logins that you had on Chrome, for instance, a click are right there. So the experiment I tried to sort of see it in action, and it's got this, I feel like this is a phrase we're going to be using a lot in the coming years, agentic mode, where it does the work for you. So I just tried a little experiment. I was thinking, okay, I'm going to have to be writing about AGMs season for all the media companies coming up. So I just said to it, go to the AFR and get me a list of all of the upcoming AGMs. And it then opened up the AFR browser. I had to click login for my AFR account. And then it just went to work while I was on another tab. And when I came back a few minutes later, it was like, here is the list of upcoming AGMs. And by the way, I also went off and checked them on another website for the Shareholders Association just to check they were correct. Similarly, though, you could say to it, find me a nice restaurant to have lunch in Launceston at the weekend and make a booking for me.
Could we not just ask our friends what a good restaurant in Launceston is? Do we need the bots to tell us, Tim? This is my concern.
Well, this is exactly my concern as well. I think we should be skeptical about how much power, how much influence we are handing over to AI. But the fact of the matter is, they're going to take that power from us.
Well, I think that we can safely say that Tim welcomes our new robot overlords, but I remain unconvinced at this stage.
I feel I've been misquoted. Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And what's your favourite regional news outlet? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.